concerned and pleased to meet you. I wish the circumstances were otherwise. It's nice to meet you. This is my husband, Mark.
Okay, first off, the issue of recording, I'm going to address the issue of recording this, and I will tell you right at the beginning, you may not have a court recorder transcribe this here, and but you may audio record it. Do you have an audio recorder? Okay, you want to set the audio recorder up here? You're welcome to do that. I look back on the May 29th letter from Assistant Presiding Judge Palmer Robinson, which says, you make audio recorder. It's all set up.
It's an audio recorder. Okay. Well, your husband is also.
Okay, good.
Okay.
All right. We're ready to then proceed. Yes, and I think we ought to begin, I don't know where you do that, but with the continuous.
Absolutely. Judge, that continuous request was our motion.
Oh, you're right. It's your motion, but that's what we ought to begin with.
Okay.
And, well, if you want to come up here, are you going to argue from there? Or, there's no reason why you can't stay up here. You should speak this early. Correct. Actually, sir, Mr. Yagorski, who's your friend?
This is my ADA.
Oh, okay. Sir. Fair enough.
We moved for a continuance on the basis of Lane Powell's discovery violations and 56F motion that we were unable to prepare all the evidence we needed to face a discovery or to face a summary judgment. The motion for continuance was unopposed. The last day that Lane Powell could file an opposition to our motion was Thursday, November the 8th. That is because the motion was dated for Tuesday, the 13th, and Monday was a court holiday, so they are required under LCR 7 to any opposition is due 2 court days prior to the date of hearing. Since it's unopposed, I believe the court should take it that Lane Powell has consented to the motion, has stipulated to the motion. And all of these facts and arguments and more are in the written motion itself and in the reply that we filed.
You did file a reply to that, didn't you?
We did file a reply, but of course the reply was not within the deadlines provided in LCR 7 because noon of the day before the court hearing was Friday, and that was when Lane Powell filed its untimely opposition, which would in all equity not provide us an opportunity to file our reply by noon or Friday.
So this was filed later, and I was out of state until the 14th of the other day. Okay. Thank you, sir. Anything
further?
Oh, yes. My name is Mark Yagorski.
Now, I'm going to ask you to keep your voice up a little bit.
Sure.
And so that the Corsi's can hear.
For record, Bob Sulkin, representing Lane Powell. Runner, we did file a motion response on Friday, a briefing response. And look, this is just, this has to be seen for what it is. It's just yet another attempt by the Corsi's to delay us getting paid. And let me just.
Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
I'm going to ask you to.
Fair enough.
Let me do it. So you're, do you agree that it was due on Thursday, November 8th?
No.
When was it due?
It was due on Friday.
It was due on Friday.
Right.
And you filed it on Friday?
Yes.
Okay. Under LCR 7?
Yes.
Okay. Fair enough. Go ahead.
This is just another effort by them to delay. And let me give you the context of this.
Okay.
If you have a question, I'm happy to answer.
I do.
Sure.
Under the requirements, do they meet the requirements for a continuance of this hearing under 56F?
No.
Okay, tell me why not.
Two reasons, Your Honor. First, they basically give you two reasons. First, they just hired a new lawyer. But that's reason number one. That was the declaration of Lischwitzen saying, I may join.
Right, they did not hire Mr. Lischwitzen.
They didn't hire Mr. Lischwitzen.
No.
So he's not even hired. They've had three previous lawyers in this case. Okay, so the idea that they didn't have enough time to hire a lawyer when this case was filed way back when is absurd, quite frankly. They've had plenty of time. This isn't a situation where, you know, we move quickly for summary judgment, they need time, their lawyer got sick, I accommodate all that, okay? But here, they've had three different lawyers, and they've been using them strategically, not to represent them in this case, number one. Number two, the documents they claim they want are completely irrelevant to any issue in this case for a couple reasons. One, they were fully available to them months and months ago. They never wanted them because of this claim of privilege. They assert and they don't assert and they assert again. Second,
if I may continue,
you've struck all their all their counterclaims from defenses, and they have no other. You've already done that. There is no other defense they have. Second, they don't take the documents have no relevance to the issue of reasonableness of the fees. Courts already found the fees to be reasonable. So all these issues, it's just another in a series of delay tactics by the due courses. And I should say, Your Honor, I understand courts concern about making sure there's a fair hearing. I believe you've gone well beyond what's fair and reasonable in this case, to a point where justice is being denied my client. We've been waiting 4 years to be paid. Okay? I mean, to put this in perspective, 4 years. And that's enough already. They've had their chance to respond. They don't have the defense. You struck them all. We need to proceed, get the case over with. They've got an appeal. Let's go forward. I'm happy to answer any question you have.
Any response, Mr. Petrosi?
Yes.
Yes, I have a response. Mr. Sulkin is quite misleading. He says we've had a number of lawyers. That's not quite true. We, after Lane Powell filed its lien, a judge, we went to Mr. Paul Fogarty to see if we can negotiate with Lane Powell. And Mr. Fogarty wrote Lane Powell a 19-page letter asking that negotiation take place and that type of thing. Lane Powell wrote back on that letter from Mr. Fogarty was dated September 22. On September 28th, Lane Powell wrote back indicating, well, okay, maybe there are some things we can talk about. Next thing we knew, there was a summons delivered to our house on October the 5th. On October the 6th, this gentleman here, Mr. Sulkin, called Mr. Fogarty and said that Lane Powell would spend $800,000 in legal fees, or was willing to spend $800,000 in legal fees in order to recoup $300,000. Quite clearly, Mr. Sulkin was threatening to wipe out our entire Windermere
award in violation of CR1 and CR11. It was basically, well, sir, forgive me, I come from Brooklyn, New York, and if someone made that threat on the street, we just call it thuggery. So we could not afford to hire Mr. Fogarty for that amount. Okay, let's see who else we have. We have one gentleman helped us in limited representation going to Mr. Sulkin's office to have a look at boxes of material. And Mr. Whitson could not represent it because we didn't have enough time. We can't get a contingency lawyer because they cannot bear up to Mr. Sulkin's threat to wipe them out for $800,000. Basically, this gentleman has denied us legal representation. That's the effective message. And we have presented this this email that Mr. Fogarty sent to us, confirming the content of that conversation and that threat. We have sent that to you several times, sir. So we'll just handle that. I hope that handles that for you.
I was trying to get at, didn't hear, Billy, was the requirements of CR 56 in terms of a continuance. I didn't hear that. 56F requires that there be identified particular discovery, specific discovery that needs to be done. A good reason why it hasn't been done today. And of course, its relevance to the motion. I think that based upon your oral arguments and your written materials, those standards haven't been met. There is an issue of resolving cases in a reasonable amount of time. Cases are expensive for everyone, and we try to make that as efficient as possible. A request for striking this motion or continuing it for 10 months would be unreasonable. Those are the options you asked for. Under any circumstances, those would be unreasonable. In terms of the opposition to the motion continuing 56F, obviously the moving parties, the plaintiffs, do object to it. I mean, it's obvious. I'll say that again. Whether the response was due on Thursday, November 8th, or on Friday. I'm not sure. I'm not going to look back on that. I haven't counted those dates. But what I look for is the overall effect of continuing on basis of that kind of circumstance would be, I think, inappropriate. You did have your opportunity to reply.
We did the objection, Your Honor. We didn't have the opportunity to reply since the hearing was on Tuesday.
Now you said you filed a reply.
We filed a reply Tuesday morning, but there's no guarantee that you ever saw it or that it got to your desk.
Oh, right. I have those matters. I mean, it hasn't been addressed until now. This is the 16th, so it's here. So I think based on that, and I think I want to make clear on the record my analysis under 56F that the motion to continue or to cancel should be and is denied. So we move to the motion second.
Thank you. Again, Bob Sulkin representing the Lake Powell.
I do want to say, though, to all you folks, I know there's a lot of feeling in this case, personal feeling. You to recognize it further, proceed especially on the issues. Your feelings about other individuals, please have been expressed here. We just move on the record, on the law, and on the facts in this case.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just to give a quick background, I know you're fully familiar with the case. The Courses paid $280,000 approximately for a house that they claimed had some
problems with into construction work.
Ms. Salkin, I don't want to interrupt too much, but I think that the issues of the Windermere lawsuit are sensitive in this case, and I don't want any suggestion in this record that anything that I am doing here is affected at all by the facts of the Windermere lawsuit. I'm going to ask you to skip over those facts.
I didn't mean to do it that way, Your Honor. I was just wanting to explain they got a lot of money. But let's move on.
Okay.
Let's just get to here. There are six independent reasons in and of themselves, each standing alone to justify summary judgment here.
Before you have one short question, this was characterized at one point as partial summary judgment, another point.
Yeah, it shouldn't have been. It's partial in the sense that we have other claims, but they would disappear. It's for all everything. So it's full summary judgment. We have different ways to get to the same result. So that's why that was confusing our part. There are at least six independent bases for summary judgment. And let me just, if I may, take you through them one by one. First, Mr. Degginger put in a declaration. Lane Powell lawyer in charge. Setting forth the reasonableness, the fees, the hours, and everything else, and it is uncontested. Okay, so unrebutted evidence is reason number one. Reason number two, on page 4 of their response brief, they concede the reasonableness of the fees. And to put a finer point on that, Gerard, what they say is, this is a contract question, whether or not the fees are reasonable is irrelevant, and they move on. So they don't even, in the brief, address the question. That's reason number two. Reason number three, you have a signed fee agreement, that is exhibit double N. You also have a statement, which is exhibit K, their letter saying, we owe you the money.
Are we on 4 now, or are we still on 3?
This is number 3.
Okay.
So you have an agreement. Call it for, and either way, you have an agreement to pay. Then you have an acknowledgement of payment, which is exhibit K. We owe you the money. That all your fees were earned, and we owe you the money. And I'm going to come back to that in a minute. Next reason, courts have already ruled on the reasonableness of the hourly rate and most of the fees already. That is, on the question of, as you recall, Your Honor, in the underlying case, some fees were covered by your fee shifting and other portions were not. But for the most part, the courts have ruled this for reasonableness of the rates and the hours, except for about $4,700, and I'll address that in a minute. You have the issue of judicial estoppel. That is, they can't take a position that the fees are reasonable in one case and unreasonable now. Okay? And they don't argue that. The next independent reason is, you have struck all their affirmative defenses and all their counterclaims. And in briefing to the Court of Appeals, which we point out in our brief, they state that's all we have. We have no other defenses but that. So on a procedural basis, they have no defense. And they have offered in their brief no evidence. Let me raise two issues, if I may. One is I think the number is $4,700, because you may recall the Court of Appeals awarded fees to us. The Supreme Court reduced the fees by $4,739.57 based on Mr. McBride's billing rate of $40. Okay? We're asking for that, but if you decide we're not entitled to it, fine. We've done the math, figure out what that comes out with, what interest. So, the really the only issue is $40 on his Court of Appeals issue, to be fair to the court. Second, the only thing they say in their response is that the lawyer's bill for copying time, I think you may have seen that. Well, first, all those other defenses would apply to that argument, but more importantly, it's just not true. Okay, and we know that. What they did was they saw, for instance, that lawyer X, they looked at the cost, and so lawyer X typed in his code copy. Okay, but if you look at the billing record, he didn't charge for it. So, for instance, Mr. Gable had copies made.
Are these copies and charges that were before the court?
Yes.
After the Windermere litigation ended that the courts reviewed and made judgments?
This is from November 07. It's already been reviewed. He doesn't say I got charged for copying. It's just a stalking horse argument. So in the end, Your Honor, you know, there's nothing more to say here. It's gone on long enough. I understand the frustration all the way around. I don't want to tie into it, but I think summary judgment is warranted, and based on both procedural reasons and in substantive reasons.
Now, question.
Sure.
So you're seeking for this court now an award of attorney's fees, which are the damages really in your case.
Correct.
So to the extent that those that whole judgment you're seeking here today is damages for the attorney's fees that were argued were earned and haven't been paid.
Yes.
All of those have been addressed by other courts, correct? Except maybe $4,700.
Well, not quite true to be fair, Your Honor, yeah. If I may.
Well, let me
sure.
Rephrase
that. Absolutely.
All of the fees that you're seeking by way of damages, I can make a distinction between damages and attorney's fees that you may be seeking and maybe not be seeking in this case. But all of the fees that you are seeking by way of damages that were fees that were earned in the Windermere litigation have been addressed by the trial court.
Yes, with an asterisk, if I may.
Yes.
Okay. There were certain claims in the underlying Windermere case, without I want to get into it, for which there was fee shifting, okay? And certain claims for which there was not fee shifting. And what the courts did was look at the fees relating to the fee shifting, but not to the others. So, for instance, in the Court of Appeals, Judge Fox in the trial court gave us $47,000 approximately fees, for certain fees. Court of Appeals says no, fee shifting didn't apply to those. And there may be some other fees related to non-fee shifting issues which may not have been addressed by the court. Our point though is, on that issue is twofold. One, as to all the fees in the underlying case, they agreed to Exhibit K that they're due and owing and fair. And second, the rates of all these fees are less. The only fees have been found to be unwarranted. They were found to be warranted by the Court of Appeals Commissioner, but not warranted by the Commissioner of the Supreme Court was the approximately $4,700 by Mr. McBride. Okay? All the money, to give you sort of, put this in a neat bow, if I may. What they want, they've been paid all their damages. Okay? They've been paid all their damages. What they want is the fees we earn. I mean, those aren't damages to them. That's money that's owed to us. So all we're asking is to be paid our fees, which are set in the lien, and we're ready to go.
What I'm trying to get at, is there any fee that you're seeking here today that was related to performance on the Windermere litigation that wasn't either A, approved by the court in the Windermere litigation, or B, was part of an application to the court in the Windermere litigation. Is there any Windermere litigation fees that you're asking them to review that haven't been reviewed by another court?
There are certain fees that have not been reviewed by court, but which they agreed to Exhibit K were reasonable. Other defenses would apply, and those same fees that were not, they put no defense into the Degenger declaration. So all those defenses I've given you, Degenger's declaration applies to all fees. Exhibit K applies to all fees, but for the ones in Court of Appeals, before the Court of Appeals looked at those, and we got blessing. All the hourly rates were reviewed and found reasonable. Okay? So I hope that fairly answers your question.
I think it does. And obviously, it should be obvious to you what I'm asking.
Yes, I understand. Thank you.
Okay, now, for defendants, is what we argue?
Well, we're both going to argue because we're both defendants in this suit. Okay. Lane Powell has asserted over and over again that they taxed all fees to Windermere that were involved in the Windermere suit. That statement alone is false. During November, December of 2008, January, February, and March 2009, there was almost $40,000 in fees that Lane Powell invoiced to us and did not tax to Windermere, though they had full opportunity to do so. That statement is false. At the Court of Appeals, Lane Powell completely consented to dropping one of the supports for the suit, the real estate purchase and sale agreement. Under the Boer v. Fritz, the Supreme Court had found that there is a full support for the expenses of the suit provided in the Windermere real estate purchase and sale agreement, supported a much broader basis for fees than were supported in the Consumer Protection Act. And so they got 100% of their fees. And under that argument, we weren't able to get 100% of our fees at trial level. At the Court of Appeals, Lane Powell permitted that leg of support for the fees to be dropped, and thereby they lost us $45,000 in costs and about $52,000 in fees at the Court of Appeals. They refused to take that issue to the Supreme Court, even though they had a contractual obligation to appeal all awards that were award setbacks in the further process. Those things directly counter what Mr. Sulkin was saying. There are a few other issues, and we did provide these in the written defense to the summary judgment. It's a bit of an annoyance to have my opponent present my arguments for me in the most unfavorable light.
I mean, it's sure, Mr. DeCarcy, it's common occurrence, whether they're lawyers on both sides or not. It's people anticipating your arguments wanting to make.
Nevertheless, I choose to be more polite, and I will not characterize his arguments, except where he says things that are directly false. The spoliation of evidence, it comes into it because we found evidence of fraud over the photocopying. Photocopying involves $42,000 in timekeeper billings, where they go to the photocopier, photocopy 1,400 pages, and go back to the desk and bill 4 or 5 hours for that day, or 3 or 4 hours, depending on what the wage earns. And I presented a spreadsheet of those costs to this court. That information was not available to the courts when Lane Powell provided the affidavits of fees and costs, and so those courts did not see them. We did not see them either. In the December 2008 agreement, which Lane Powell has structured as being part of the agreement, the two of them together, it refers to them as, quote, the agreement in its motion for summary judgment. If so, we should look at those two documents, one signed in 2007, one signed in 2008, we should look at them as a unity. And as a unity, they are in violation of the rules of professional conduct. Specifically, Rule 1.8 provides that a lawyer shall not make an agreement prospectively limiting a lawyer's liability to a client for malpractice unless presented, permitted by law, and the client is independently represented. When we signed those agreements, we were not independently represented. Lane Powell inserted a clause in the 2008 agreement that says that the DeCourcys agreed that Lane Powell's fees were honestly derived and were necessarily incurred in this litigation, given our opponent's strategy. They've taken that clause, they've inserted, imported it into the summary judgment, and they used it exactly as the rules of professional conduct forbids them to do, which is as a prospective, as a prospective limitation on our ability to claim malpractice against Lane Powell. There is one more thing I'd like to present. The discovery issue comes up again because we specifically asked Lane Powell to support its costs that it billed us, support those costs with documentation. Instead, Lane Powell, in some places, refused to answer the interrogatories, refused to answer the productions. This is in our motion to continue this hearing. In other places, they waved vaguely at 35 banker boxes full of documentation and said, it's in there. It's in the discovery material, the support for their costs. Well, it isn't in there. They said the needle is someplace in that haystack, therefore we don't have to answer your question. But that isn't an answer to the question. I could also say that answer is someplace in the public library, and that isn't an answer to the question. There, hold on just a moment. The discovery materials that they dumped on us after they moved for summary judgment included 11,000, what they say is 11,000 documents, but in fact turns out to be 63,000 files. They even admit, effectively, to spoliating those files. They say in the log that they're Microsoft Word files, but when they get to us, they're only pictures of those documents. Pictures that cannot be indexed, cannot be searched, cannot be compiled. All that can be done is printed and looked over laboriously. In effect, by producing that flood late in October, after filing for summary judgment, after dragging their feet for 10 months on the production of this discovery material, they have fallen firmly into the qualification of CR 56F, which says you can't do it. You can't. They should be subject to the spoliation rule. The spoliation rule says you must infer that what they are hiding by spoliating the evidence, by destroying the files and tearing them up, by withholding them from us and then dumping them 1 week before our response is due, that what they have, the court must infer that the evidence is contrary to their claims and contrary to their defenses. That's a standard rule in Washington courts. And since we have proven some fraud among their billing, then it's reasonable to infer that what they are hiding by withholding evidence is more fraud. And fraud vitiates everything it touches.
Thank you. Mr. Percy?
Yes, thank you very much, Judge.
First of all,
we will agree that this court has stricken our counterclaims because it says so on the piece of paper that you gave us. We'll do with that. And depends on the claim for fiduciary duty, fraud, breach of contract, conflict of interest.
Excuse me. Now, a couple of things.
Yes.
Maybe, are you comfortable coming up here?
Oh, yes.
Okay. And I think
certainly.
the problem the court reporter is having hearing you is when you look down.
Okay, sure.
You keep your head up. Maybe it would be easier.
Yeah. So, okay. So what we claimed for was that the breach of fiduciary duty, fraud, breach of contract, conflict of interest, malpractice, consumer protection violation, malicious prosecution, unjust enrichment, and extortion. Now, all of those courses of action, claims, what have you, defenses, have been stricken. What happens when we go to trial? Mark and I will, just having all of our defenses and counterclaims taken from us, will we be like the people who had all of our limbs amputated? I mean, what will a jury think? What is the scenario that you envision after this?
I'll answer that question.
Yeah.
Because my understanding is that it is the plaintiff's position in this case that if the motion for summary judgment is granted here, there is nothing left to try.
I get it. Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you for clarifying that. Okay.
Mr. Sullivan, you have an opportunity to respond.
Okay. Thank you, sir. All right. Now, that, I would say, was very good legal work on Lane Powell's part. But let's have a look at how they got to where they are, their present state. First thing, Lane Powell told his court by outfiring them on August the 3rd, 2011, we broke that contract with Lane Powell. And they said that in their complaint on page 3, lines 25, approximately line 25. Okay, but right here, sir, I have our agreement on September 19, 2007, and that agreement stipulates that either of us, Lane Powell or DeCourcy's, can terminate the agreement at any time. So the fact that we terminated them on August 3rd, 2011 was not a breach of contract, and I have that paper right here. So that's an untruth, they told the court. And they knew it was untrue when they told the court. Number two, Lane Powell told the court after we fired them that we secretly made an arrangement with Windermere for Windermere to pay us the final satisfaction of judgment, and that we went behind Lane Powell's back to make that arrangement. And they said that in the plaintiff's motion to require deposit of funds at the court registry, December 13, 2011, page 1, lines 1 to 5. Sir, I offer you this. This is a declaration signed by Lane Powell's Grant Dagenger on December the 30th, 2011, in which he swears under penalty of perjury, etc., that he knew back in August 2011 that we were doing exactly that. He spoke to our replacement counsel on this very subject. So Lane Powell fully knew that we were attempting to get a payment of the judgment. So that's lie number two. Forgive me, misrepresentation number two. I'll try to clean my language up to make it loyally. Okay. All right. So, now, moreover, on September 28th, 2011, and I have that letter here, Lane Powell wrote to Mr. Paul Fogarty, who had attempted to negotiate a settlement, in which he said that Lane Powell has not refused to cooperate with the DeCourcy's in efforts to obtain payment. To the contrary, we would like to see that the DeCourcy's are paid. Lane Powell simply asserted a lien for payment and its fees in accordance with RCW 60.40.010 and applicable law. So that is another verification of the Lane Powell untruths. They're a untruth machine. Just keep on churning it out, churning it out, churning it out. Okay, next point. Lane Powell told the court that we lied about the amount of money on Lane Powell's lien claim and cheated it of the full lien amount. That's what they said, and they said that on the motion to require the deposit of funds into the court registry December 19th, page 1, lines 19 to 26. But Lane Powell's own witness, Pamela O'Connor, herself testified in court about the amount of Lane Powell's lien, and this document is right here. In O'Connor's sworn declaration, she testified to a figure that was exactly the same amount as we stated in our court packets. So Lane Powell's witness actually testifies against the veracity of Lane Powell's statements. Next point. Lane Powell has told the court that Windermere sued us after the judgment had been secured against Windermere, and because we then failed to pay Lane Powell. And they said that in the response to our motion to vacate and recuse, Your Honor, on they said that on August 15, 2011, page 4, lines 13 to 14. But let's think this through carefully. Lane Powell has demanded payment. Lane Powell had demanded payment after the judgment was paid. The first partial payment of judgment was filed on November the 4th. Now, they filed their suit on October the 5th. October the 5th comes before November the 4th. So then, knowing yet we had not yet been paid, Lane Powell filed suit against us for not paying them, pretending that we had run away with their pot of gold. But that's not true either. Okay, they've told myriad untruths throughout this proceeding. Okay, why is telling the truth important? Because the courts must find the truth so they can dispense justice. Therefore, it's wrong to lie to the court. Most especially, it's wrong for officers of the court, attorneys, to knowingly make provably false statements. And sir, forgive me for my frankness. It's even more wrong for judges to knowingly accept those provenly untrue statements, allow the untruthful statements to stand, and to adopt the untruthful statements as judicial verities. But now let me move on to the discovery controversy. The very day Lane Powell filed its suit, it issued a series of discovery requests which demanded all of our attorney-client privileges on all subjects. Judges and experienced litigators know the rules of discovery and evidence. They know that CR 26B, ER 502, and the Pappas v. Holloway precedent apply. There was no legitimate reason for charging us with discovery violations. We told them they could, we absolutely concede all kinds of documents having to do with the subject of the lawsuit, which is breach of contract and blah, blah, blah. The suit is an argument about fees and services. They have that kind of material. But their message was simple. Pay up whatever we demand, or we'll force your confidences into evidence. In ordinary parlance, this is called extortion, and we justifiably charge Lane Powell with exactly that. But nonetheless, this discovery brouhaha was used as an excuse to strike at claims and defenses. I ask several things. First of all, I say that law firms are a part of our system of public trust. Judges should not allow them to do what Lane Powell has done, lie to the court repeatedly about basic issues of the case and get away with it. Law firms cannot be permitted to treat their clients like Enron, the WorldCom, and Bernie Madoff treated their clients. Most especially, law firms cannot be permitted to blackmail their clients under privileged materials.
I'm sorry.
Blackmail. Law firms must not be permitted to blackmail their clients over privileged materials. I ask the court to restore the trust of the people this state has put in the judicial system, to repudiate the lies Lane Powell has hitherto put before the court and the court has accepted, that the court restore our counterclaims and defendants, and that the court deny Lane Powell's motion to partial summary judgment. And Judge, I really do understand your sympathy with the issue of Windermere. It's, we have done our very best to expose their unlawful actions and the corruption of the government agencies that allows them to have an unfair place in the marketplace. And I understand that your wife works for them and you love her and she loves you and all of that. And we're sympathetic to that, but really, sir, it doesn't look good. And it doesn't feel good, and it's not good.
Sure, I understand it. I just want you to understand, please, my wife is not involved with this agent or with the office of the agent.
I understand, sir. Yes, I do.
It's an independent agent, like Postar.
Yeah, but Windermere operates, believe me, we've been through, Windermere operates as a single company, and you're doing so, but they do so, they do indeed. You know, we should have a look at our webpage, WindermereVictims.com. You might learn quite a lot about the wife's employer. Okay, so we can understand that you're feeling protective, but still, anyway, enough said.
Okay.
Thank you very much, though, for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you. First, on the issue of the cost, $45,000 in costs that they're now kind of thought of, those costs were reviewed by Judge Fox and approved. In fact, if you look at Exhibit H, which is the Court of Appeals decision, if you turn your eye to page 36, that it explains exactly what happened. What happened was that Judge Fox, and I'm at that second full paragraph, here the record reveals, and the footnote. What happened was Judge Fox ordered the defendants to pay costs $45,442. In other words, he looked at everything and said, you owe it. And he said, you owe it under the real estate purchase and sale agreement. And the Court of Appeals said, wait a minute, you're not suing the seller. So the very costs that they're claiming were subject to fraud, it just, all the reasons I gave you apply there. Lastly, in Exhibit A, page 4, is there a brief in the Court of Appeals where they say all of their defenses are the ones you struck? So I'm happy to answer Exhibit A, page 4, if that's true for Your Honor.
No, I've got
yeah. Sure. And obviously, I dispute the claims that Mrs. DeCourcy made about Lane Powell lying and the rest. Yeah. I'm not going to take them on one by one. But I'm happy to answer the question.
Okay, hold on. I have a basic question. Let me ask this. Again, this is a repeat of the question I asked you before. In this case, your client is seeking, by way of damages, not a fee petition, fees, this is an action for damages now, for outstanding, for action for damages for fees that have either been approved by courts related to Windermere litigation, or were fees which the DeCourcys participated in submitting to the court as reasonable and necessary to Windermere litigation. Is that correct?
There were certain fees that were not submitted to the court that everyone agreed were not covered by fee shifting.
Okay. So if they were submitted to the court on those fees, are you asking me at this time to determine reasonableness of those fees, or have they already been determined by some prior proceedings here?
The hourly rates we believe have been determined to be reasonable because the same board is working on. The number of hours we believe we put in evidence before you, that is declaration, laying out all the fees, and there's no response. Now, I believe you can look at those fees, that declaration, and decide whether you believe there's something improper. We don't believe there are. There is. Period.
Excuse me, just so I understand as we go along, are those fees that you're they're asking me to look at to determine if I see there's anything wrong with them related to the Winter Garden litigation.
Yes.
Correct.
Yes.
Okay. And where do I find those fees set up?
The Dekinger Declaration is attached to our opening brief. Opening brief.
Thank you.
Okay. Now, with respect to those fees, do any of the estoppel arguments that you made apply?
The fees covered by Judge Fox's ruling that were upheld by court appeals? Yes.
No, those are all covered.
Yeah.
Right. But to the additional fees, the ones that haven't been submitted to court, that were held back, in what way in this proceeding have the DeCourcy's agreed that those were reasonable fees?
Okay. They've done it three ways, if I may, Your Honor, in the format of summary judgment. First, they have not responded to the Dekinger Declaration. You put in a declaration, and they could have put in something saying these were unreasonable. They have not done that. Second, if you look at their response brief, Your Honor, at page 4, their response brief, lines 10 through 13. It says, Lane Powell spends much of its tax arguing that its fees were quote unquote reasonable. I'll wait to get to that. Lines 10 through 13.
Page 4, 10 through 13.
Yes. Line, such argument is inappropriate and irrelevant. In other words, they don't even take it on, the issue. I mean, they don't argue that they're not reasonable. So we put in a Dekinger Declaration. So not only do they not put in something in response, they have nothing to even say about it from a legal point of view. Third argument is you struck all their defenses. I mean, at the end of the day, you struck their defenses in for good reason, and for a reason the Court of Appeals refused to flip. Next reason, Exhibit K, is a letter they sent to us, okay? It's framed as rewriting it to them, in which they say.
Exhibit K, do you have Exhibit K?
Yes, we have Exhibit K.
Okay, that's what we're talking about.
But it's not a letter from us to them.
Okay.
If I may, yeah.
I have it in front of me, I see
okay.
It.
Okay. You'll see, there's a fact from them, Mr. Norris, at Lane Powell's, where they sign, asking Norris to sign, okay? In other words, the first page of the exhibit is the facts, and one page back. You'll see it's from Mark DeCourcy to Brent Norris. Norris is the Lane Powell lawyer, okay? And he says, please fax back signed copy, have ready for pickup, okay? And so, if we go to page 2, they say they'll agree to pay all the fees. And not only that, they're fair, honest, and everything else. So, again, each of these are independent reasons. If K didn't exist, you'd still have all the others. If the others didn't exist, you'd still have K. And if none existed, you'd still have your order denying all their defenses, striking all their defenses. And so, at the end of the day, no matter how you take it, you come to the same place.
I wish I could go back and redraft that, because what I meant is strike all the defenses and still put upon the plaintiff the requirement to prove their claim.
And, Your Honor, I took it that way, which is why I put the Dekinger Declaration into evidence so that we would be proving our claim. Okay? And ultimately, that is our, we came forth with our burden, we put the evidence before you. In fact, Judge Fox gave us a 30% kicker on our fee because we did such a great job, we meaning Lane Powell, and they haven't responded to the evidence we put forward.
How much is in the Dekinger Declaration that was not passed on or agreed to in the...
I did not separate it out. I can do, if you need that number...
I think I need to.
I can't do that right now, Your Honor, but I do. If not, I can separate that out for you.
And I am...
I believe the number's around, if I may, 100 and something, 100 to 200,000, something in there.
So it's a substantial amount. And all based, though, on hourly rates that were approved by courts during the course of this proceeding.
Correct, Your Honor. And which, just to be fair, and the number of hours have not been attacked by them in this case.
How readily comes to your mind the case of Mahler versus Suits?
I'm sorry.
Mahler versus Suits.
S-C-U-C-S. To be fair, doesn't.
Okay. All right.
But I'm pretty good at the law, if you want to look at
the
way
it comes. And the question that's embedded in this is the court's independent responsibility.
Which is why, Your Honor, I think the court, you said this is a, if I may, you said to me this is a damages claim by Lane Powell, and that's true. I don't think, at the end of the day, the jury gets to decide the fairness of fees. That's a court decision, which is why we put this before you.
Okay. The distinction that you're making is when fees are damages rather than approval of fees as reasonable fees.
Yeah. But we think both are, I think the court, we think the court should look at the fees to make sure it's comfortable with them. In other words, that I don't have a problem with, which is why we put them before you if you feel that way. I'm just saying, we laid it all out. They don't have anyone coming in saying they're unreasonable. You do have an independent obligation.
And that would just be as to, then, as it appears to me here, to the number of hours.
Right. Which is why, Your Honor, if I may, I started, and I'll try and keep this short, on the Windermere case. And the reason I said it is that Judge Fox himself said, and we put his transcript, it's law,
yes,
he himself said the reason there was so much was spent on fees was because of Windermere's coverage. I mean, Judge Fox looked at the number of hours in this case, clearly, at least as the covered issues, but as a whole. And he blamed Windermere for that very issue. So we have some statement as to the number of hours and why they may have been high, but if you subtract out, I think the number is, if you just took what's out of their pocket, the case where they get $822,000, that was the damages award, that is $522 in damages plus $270 in settlement, the total fees out of their pocket is $115,000. I mean, it's by any measure, that's reasonable. But again, well, it's about there. Short answer is no. The longer answer is I don't know that it's that simple, because you had a situation, Your Honor, where certain claims were covered and certain weren't, but the work was done as to both. And so I believe what happened, though I wasn't there, Judge Fox looked at everything, and he kind of does this. He says, this is what's a fair number of hours. So it became difficult. If it was easy, I certainly would have done that for you.
And there are some hours here that were not approved by any court or that was involved in the Lindner litigation, and that were not supported by declaration, affidavit, or some representation by the DeCourcys that those fees were reasonably incurred, and asking someone else to pay for them.
That I don't think is accurate, Your Honor. If Exhibit K, which you just looked at, applies to all the fees in the underlying case, all 522, because that case finished. Then after that, there was an appeal to the Court of Appeals.
Yes.
The Court of Appeals did review the hours and approved all the hours on appeal. Yeah, all on appeal. So in that sense, everything is covered between the letter and the Court of Appeals, and it all is covered by Dechinger's declaration. But the separation is a little bit dicey, only because some work is done for some things, and now it's hard to break it out.
Clean. But what I'm really trying to parse out of this is those specific hours that haven't been reviewed by some prior judicial officer or haven't been represented as reasonable by the DeCourcys.
I understand that. And there are no hours, if I understand your question, there are no hours that the DeCourcys take an issue with because they haven't responded.
That's slightly different.
All right, I'm not trying to be crafty. No, let me try again to understand.
No, my question is that were specifically represented by the DeCourcys as being reasonable.
I'm sure it's me.
Such as in an application for an award of fees to the court, it wasn't granted.
There are no hours, I think I understand the question. It's Friday and 3 o'clock, it's me and not you.
I don't know.
There is no hours that a court has found to be unreasonable. That is correct. No court has ever found, other than the rate that Mr. McBride in the Court of Appeals, which is $4,700, has called out. That's the only thing any court has ever found to be reasonable. But even as to those hours, the commissioner of the appellate court found those to be appropriate.
But, and here's what I'm trying to get at. Is there anything in the declaration that wasn't submitted to some court?
I have not compared Dechinger's declaration to
what I'm trying to get at. Is what hours you're asking me to look at to make a reasonableness determination?
I believe it would be the hours Judge Fox didn't approve. I don't think Judge Fox was able to, if you know what I mean. And I know it puts you in a tough spot, but I'm trying to be fair.
Yeah. No, that's fine. Because here's, and you described that as perhaps being a substantial amount of money, $300,000,
$200,000. It may be. I have to go back.
Okay. So tell me how I can approach this without going over all the work that another trial court and the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court has done. I suppose the Supreme Court could tell the court my DC parse out. But how am I to approach that without going over what's already been gone over?
You may, if you think you have to do the exercise, you may have to, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I may not be the answer you want to hear from me. But what we do have from me is there's no one claiming. The reason you don't have to, is this. One, if you feel you have to, you have to, in a sense, go over it. And I can't easily segregate out for you and say every hour after November 2nd of X years you have to look at. I can't make it that easy for you. What I can say is they don't complain about the reasonableness of the fees because they're arguing fraud and all these other things. And they don't complain about the number of hours because they put in nothing else. Their defenses are all around these sort of ideas of fraud, which we know the Court of Appeals has addressed because and Judge Fox is there.
Now, with respect to the fees that you're asking or the awards that you're seeking here, are you asking as part of this motion, award of attorney's fees for your services representing Lane Powell?
No. No. I mean, we've made a motion to you, which you granted on sanctions. The fees we're asking here are solely the fees that are being the lien plus what's in lien plus interest. I mean, it's just the underlying case. It's got nothing to do with me. We're not asking for my fee. It's part of this motion. Any other questions? Thank you.
Final word?
Yes, please. I wish I could see Exhibit K. Mr. Sulkin, do you have a copy of Exhibit K that I can see?
Well, I'll tell you what. I'm not going to go there. I'm going to give you one.
Okay.
JK, pull it out a bit.
Your Honor, if I may correct one statement. Ms.
Yes.
Haley believes that, and I'd want to double check this, but to just give you a sense of scope.
Sure.
But the number we're talking about is about $71,225, which is our fees beyond that, which Judge Fox found to be addressed.
Right. But okay. Those are the fees that were related to Windmere.
Absolutely. They're all underlying cases. Okay.
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 This letter in Exhibit K.
Get that back. That has full punch in it. I put my.
Oh. The letter in Exhibit K was written by Lane Powell and addressed to us. It was not from us to Lane Powell. They sent us the letter. We signed ours. It was unsigned when he sent it to us. We signed it, and we sent it to them and asked them to send a ratified copy to us. They never did. And, but you see that it's the addressee line is Carol and Mark DeCourcy, and the signature line is Brent Nurse of Lane Powell, B.C. They wrote this agreement.
And you agreed in this, apparently, that the Lane Powell's fees were...
That is an illegal term. According to the RPC, Mr. Sulkin has not addressed that. But that is illegal under RPC, I think it's 1.8. It says that a lawyer shall not make an agreement prospectively limiting the lawyer's liability to a client. And that's the way they've used it over and over again in the written pleading for this and in his oral argument.
Okay, got it.
So under the RPC, that agreement is void. Under that case, Simberg, Ketter, and Shepherd. Great. It's not a valid agreement.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, I thought you were about to ask me.
No.
Okay. Also, the court papers provide a very clear picture of what fees they submitted to the court and which they did not. You go into the motion for fees, you see that the invoices are blacked out. In line after line after line, things they did not submit to the court for fees, things that Judge Fox did not see, things that no court saw. And by those items, you can tell what was submitted to the courts and what was not. Also, all the fees, as I said earlier, all the fees, notice that November, December, January, February of 2008 and 2009, they didn't submit any of those fees either, and you can see where the invoices, the fee motion to the judge cut off, and you can see from Degenger's declaration where they just kept on a going and kept on a billing us. In spite of the fact of having written that fee motion late in February, they also, after the court decided that they were going to pay 12% interest, that Windermere was going to pay 12% interest. Lane Powell made a private agreement without consulting us that Windermere would pay 3.49% interest, post-judgment interest.
Now you're getting back to the arguments you've already made.
I didn't mention that earlier.
I think you did.
Okay.
But
I'm sorry.
You got it now.
Okay.
There you go. But what I want to say is that I've given you a little extra latitude in terms of a further reply here, but it's not opening the door to going through all of your arguments.
Oh, okay. Right. All right. Also, the Court of Appeals also trimmed off hours. Mr. Sulkin says again and again that the only court that did it was the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals. They both trimmed hours from the claims that Lane Powell submitted. They trimmed, neither one of them found the claims to be reasonable. There was also the fact that Lane Powell originally estimated the case at $100,000 and then billed us for $480,000 for the trial. That just for the trial phase. That was part of the verbal contract. We haven't argued that. The reason we haven't argued about reasonableness of fees is because Lane Powell did not move this court for summary judgment on quantum merit. They moved the court for summary judgment only on breach of contract. So it's the contract terms that we are arguing. And that's why we said it was irrelevant. That to argue reasonableness is to ask the court to determine whether or not they're reasonable. And that, I would think, would be more of a fact finding, but that's just my opinion. Okay. So,
you can keep that.
Thank you for your
hearing me.
Sir, may I offer you these documents? These are the documents that prove Lane Powell tells lies about facing. They have impeached the credibility of themselves as witnesses.
Yeah.
Lane Powell lies.
Yeah. Mr. Percy, the documents that upon which this motion has to be decided have already been presented.
We've presented this to you before, sir, many, many times. Does it matter when lawyers lie to judges, or should that be swept under the table? I don't understand. Please explain.
We have a process by which a person who wants summary judgment says what they want in summary judgment and provides the documents that they think necessary, the affidavits that are necessary to support that. The responding parties get to put in their, make their arguments and put in their documents that they think support their view. Then we have a reply, which isn't supposed to put in new matters, but it's argument about the case. And then that closes the record for the purposes of the summary judgment. That says, okay, that's what the judge has to decide this case on, this summary judgment. Each side has had the opportunity and the responsibility to put in those documents that they think are appropriate for that. So, and we have a strict rule, on adding something new after everyone's kind of gone through that process.
But what about the credibility of the witness, sir? They have just said lies. I was brought up funny. I was always told to tell the truth and certainly tell the truth in court.
This
I can't understand why people tell lies like
this. This is based upon material facts that are really not disputed. And that's what their burden is, to show material facts that are not disputed. Now, you may disagree about a lot of things, but it's a question of whether there's a disagreement about and evidence to support a disagreement about material facts, facts that are important to the decision that's made. And I'm going to find that in terms of the obligation for attorney's fees to Lane Powell, that they've met that burden. They have judgment for the attorney's fees that are owed to Lane Powell. And those would include all attorney's fees that have been approved by courts that have been paid. I just want you to understand that when you go to a court and ask a court to approve attorney's fees and say, here are my attorney's fees, and these are reasonable hourly, I want you, court, to have somebody else pay those. And then the court says, okay, you know, whatever degree percentage. Court says yes, okay, I agree, these are reasonable. Somebody else should pay those because of the nature of the case. And then that someone else comes back and does pay them, and so you benefit from that, you can't then go back and say those fees were not reasonable. It just wouldn't be fair for you now to come back and say, no, those weren't reasonable fees, even though I said they were before, and I got paid for them now.
But Lane Powell saying that, not us.
So those fees that have been approved by the courts, those are be part of the summary judgment here. Those fees that may not have ended up in a court order, but that were part of a petition to a court, are clearly included here because those were court, those that were submitted on your behalf and for you. So, and the only question I have now are any additional fees, and there are additional fees, but those fees were put forward here and a request was made for those fees and there was no objection to those fees. I think I can find, without getting into any Windermere evaluation, that then the courts have approved those hourly rates. That representation has been made. There's been no indication that that isn't so. It's in the record. So the hourly rates are all determined to be reasonable. It's the only question is on the number of hours, whether the number of hours are reasonable. Now, that hasn't been a dispute from you and on that. I may just go back and check a little law on that to ensure that if the fact that you did not dispute those in this period closes the book on that, then I will, then we'll close the book on that. If it says that I have to go back and make an independent review of those, if that's what the law is, then that's another question. And that's something that I'm concerned would bring me into an evaluation of the Windermere litigation and put me in a position of an appearance that I shouldn't be doing that because of my wife's occupation as an independent agent working out of the Windermere office, going back and evaluating in a sense of Windermere. And I may, if that comes to that, I will look at the law and I need to find out whether I can rely on the absence of objection. But if it comes to that, I may defer that to another judge.
For the just a review of the
okay. Yes, yeah. And I do that for, I don't have any prejudice or bias in favor of Windermere. It's a big organization, it's like a lot of others. I don't have any connection to my family or otherwise with the transactions that caused your lawsuit. For Windermere. I have no financial stake in Windermere. My wife doesn't. She earns commission from her sales of houses she's involved with and pays a portion of that to Windermere. The Windermere franchise that she works for, which was not the Windermere franchise involved here. But in any event, I don't think I have a conflict on that, but I respect your concern. And so I think that if it comes down to my evaluating litigation that involved Windermere directly and might involve then some evaluation of Windermere's conduct, then I think I would at that point recuse and leave that issue to another judge. I don't know if we have to be there or not. I don't know that we don't have it already covered.
I make a quick,
yeah.
Your Honor, we'll obviously respect your decision and what you feel comfortable. Okay, Windermere, but the hours you'd be looking at hours that we're not asking Windermere to pay. I think your point would be well taken, even stronger, if we've been asking Windermere to pay money, but we're not. But I'll leave that to you.
Yes, well, that's a nice distinction. So what I'm going to ask you to do, so I will grant the motion for all aspects on this case without reservation in terms of that amount. And I'm going to ask you to give me a submission on that. You need to go back and kind of take a look at this again. Maybe
okay.
You can make it clear that it wasn't involved in the Windermere, or the Windermere wasn't asked to pay that. But first, the legal analysis as to whether because there having been no objection to those, is whether that is sufficient or...
And just so I understand, you're... I'm happy to Mr. DeCourcy go first.
No.
Okay. I just want to be clear what you expect from us.
Okay.
Do you want anything entered formally today?
But you may, if you can scratch it out that way. But...
Okay.
If there is an issue that a judge is required to review the reasonableness of some hours, then obviously you have to do that.
Right.
I'm not sure that we have to do that.
Would you like us to make a submission on that?
Yes.
Okay. When would you like that submission by you?
Well, I'm going to be gone all next week. So, you know, all next week.
All right.
I work on Thanksgiving to do it.
Maybe what I'll do as far as the submission is concerned, go back to the office and...
And the second part of it, you know, the law on that. It should be not more than 3 pages, maybe 2 pages.
Right. That's all I'm thinking.
But if you can then on that identify with more clarity hours that need to be completed, I think that's going to be helpful.
Understood.
Yeah. And I think it's your declaration. If there's some way of setting off those hours that are the ones that, if a judge needs to review them, these are the hours, that would be really helpful.
Okay. And then the last question I have, is do you want to rule today or later on the question of McBride, that $4,700 issue?
And McBride, $4,700 issue, I think, was a matter of $40 an hour?
Correct. He was charged with $440 and the court said $400.
$400. And the court ruled on it, said $400.
Well, actually, the court commissioner did, not the full court.
Right.
The court commissioner did, so there's not a chance to...
Whoever is the final arbiter on it, so...
Yes, that was the last decision was the commission.
And so you want the $40, you're asking for $40. Per hour, the $4,700. Now, if that commissioner, that judicial officer, reviewed that and said this is reasonable, this isn't, then what's your basis for it? It could be reasonable to the client, but not reasonable to cost shift.
Correct, Your Honor. And that commissioner is, with due respect to the commissioner, it's not a full judicial proceeding with full judicial.
Okay.
Correct.
Okay, so to the extent that you can mark out that what you're really asking me to do then is to go back and look at that hourly rate. Did they approve the full time?
Yes.
So it's just the hourly rate?
Just the hourly rate, whether you think 400 or it should be 440.
Okay. So if you're asking me to make a determination on that, I have to have a basis for it.
Correct.
So you need to give me whatever that after it is, because that's the reason.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Now, you folks understand that then there will be an order presented and there's going to be this little brief on whether there are some hours that were that they're seeking, that they call a seeking to recover on here, that I need to review for reasonableness of the number of hours, and that I may not have to and may not require it. And if it doesn't require that, then those will be granted. If it does require that, then I think that if it does require that, I think that I'll pass that off to the judge to occur, because then that gets us into looking at the area.
Just a quick point,
sure.
Your Honor. On the subject of reasonableness, the problem was alluded to, someone said here that the problem was Windermere. They kept on using aggressive litigation. Now, here's the issue. We asked Lane Powell to ask for CR 11 sanctions. They absolutely would not do it. Lane Powell mined this case for legal fees. It was a CPA case, and they used it shamelessly to mine legal fees. $100,000 estimate, $480,000 to end of trial. It's not reasonable. It's a racket. It's a racket.
Okay. Now, I would entertain signing an order that goes as far as we've gone in today, so you can know for presentation probably is the best way in order. You don't have one there if you're scratching one out.
Well, here's what I've done, Your Honor, and I'm happy to do it any, obviously any way you want. I have an order that grants us the full amount, and then I put an asterisk saying, however, the party shall submit briefs and going on, trying to get what you said and understanding this order is not final. But, or we can just wait, and I think we have a record, a pretty good record here of what you want to do, whatever you're comfortable with.
Well, the only part of that that is concerns me is if we end up saying the order isn't final, then
the order of the order on the liability is final except for the hours not covered.
Right. Yeah. Okay. I think we can enter an order of liability, and I think that would probably be good for us to enter as much as we can here now.
I don't understand why the court keeps saying there's no objection to the fees. We have presented evidence of fraud. We have, in our written presentation, we presented that they mined the case and refused to get CR 11 sanctions and to limit Windermere's flagrant galaxies of arguments. Why does the court say there has been no objection to we objected at the time in letter after letter, and we've presented those letters, there's quite a packet, in our submission to the court on summary judgment. Why are these things being ignored?
Perhaps I spoke a little broadly on that, and I...
Mr. Sulkin has also said the same thing over and over again.
Give me an opportunity to answer. Perhaps I was a little broad on that, but what I meant was in terms of the hourly rate, hourly hours, the reasonableness of the hours that we've been talking about, with Mr. Sulkin, that are unclear as to whether I have to review those for reasonableness or not. Those are the hours I'm talking about, and just those.
But where has there been no objection? I missed something.
In this motion, and the motion was made, your response, there was no...
Yes, there was. There was.
Objection on your part to the reasonableness of those powers.
Yes, we did. We showed you that there was fraudulent billing.
Okay. Now, what's going to happen?
Yeah, that's not an, I don't understand why that's not an objection. Can we just address that one point?
Try to respond. We're going to enter a partial order here, and then Mr. Sulkin or his partners will give me a brief with respect to whether I need to look at those for reasonableness or not. And you'll have an opportunity to respond. You'll get a copy, you know how this goes, you'll get a copy of the brief, and then you'll get an opportunity to send your own brief. You can lay out whatever you think is wrong with their motion. And then they'll reply. I would anticipate that this would be a motion without oral argument. But if either party requests oral argument on it, then it just make it maybe a little more difficult. So.
Your Honor, may I read what I wrote? Just
sure.
So it fairly captures what you said. And said, I have an order here which uses the number 422-675, which is plus the interest. I can ask for by every place that is in the order. And I wrote, however, the party shall submit briefs, no longer than 3 or 4 pages, and whether this court must review the number of hours worked by Lane Powell or previously not reviewed by other courts to determine reasonableness. As of such hours, no summary judgment shall be entered. Additionally, briefing on whether Ms. McBride's rate in the appellate process may be challenged is due by November 3rd.
Okay, at that time?
Yeah. That would be okay for us.
I'm mindful of next week is what next week is.
Yeah, that's fine.
But again, you know, 3 or 4, because we doubled up on the issues there, I think 5 pages, 5 legitimate pages. And sometimes when we get down to this point, we say 5 pages.
5 footnotes. All right, I'll change it to 5 pages, no footnote.
But you don't have to put the no quit.
Okay. We're just going to change three or four.
We haven't signed anything.
Okay. Yes. They're not, they won't sign okay. this. All right. But I'm going to change this to.
Okay, Mr. and Mrs. DeCourcy, I understand that you've declined to sign.
We both have, sir. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I don't speak to my husband, but I heard him say he's not going to sell it.
Okay, Mr.
Yeah, we.
I don't even understand what it is you want us to sign. That it's reasonable?
No.
Sign that we don't object? What?
No, that this order, that the summary judgment motion is granted, and that we are going to, though, to the extent requested, accept that we're going to go look back at certain hours to see if I have to determine whether they're reasonable or not. If I don't have to go through a reasonableness determination on those hours, then this would be the final order. If I do have to go through a reasonableness determination on those hours, then it will be my, I'm thinking very seriously about assigning that to a different judge.
Okay, we understand that part of it. What is it that Mr. Sulkin thinks we ought to sign?
Well, it's an order that says that.
We would have to study it scrupulously in light of the phenomenal lies these people tell, Your Honor.
Okay. You're going to get a copy of it. We make copies for both sides. Okay. Thank you. Anything? Okay, thank you very much. The folks, I have another matter.